You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Welcome to episode one of Destination Freedom Black Radio Days podcast. I'm your host and director, Donnielle Betts. Destination Freedom is a radio series recorded live in front of a studio audience, which is then followed by a community discussion about the subject of the play.
Equality. All we are asking for is equality. We are asking for Black to stop being a death sentence. We are asking for you to let our children be free. As we gather here tonight, reflecting on a little boy whose life was taken because of the color of his skin, I want you to remember what it means to be Black.
Destination Freedom is an audio journey through the Black experience in America and other unheard voices. Destination Freedom came to be in 1948 and ended in 1950. All the shows were written by Radio Hall of Fame writer Richard Durham. Now, I revived this show in 1998, and I have been producing the series ever since. When first produced, the series walked a daring line between reform and revolution and was shut down by its network in 1950 because of its pro-Black stance and McCarthyism tightened its grip on America broadcasting. This season, join us as we will examine the intersection of law enforcement and communities of color, exploring police shootings, immigration, and gender bias. This first show, Black with a capital B, will explore what it means to be a young Black man in America. Black, written by Lamari Amina, kind of describes it this way. After one young Black man dies at the hands of police, a community is shaken. A conversation evolves between two mothers at the visual, one white and one Black. Through this interaction, Black gets to the heart of the matter on communication between races. We also will hear from Samaria Rice, the mother of Tamir Rice. Tamir Rice, at 12 years old, was shot and killed by police in Cleveland as he played in a park near his home. The cast features performers such as Black, Deva Keys as White, Carrie K.J. Joy as theme performer on violin, Monique Brooks Roberts, and Andrew Jacob Betts as the kid. Join us after the performance for a robust community conversation about our subject with law enforcement and community activists.
Oh, freedom. Oh, sweet freedom. Oh, I cry freedom over me. And before I'll be anybody's slave, I will be buried in my very own grave and go home to my Lord and be free. Where there is no more sorrow, where there is no more crying, where there is no more pain over me. And before I will be anybody else's slave, I commit that I'll be buried in my very own grave and go home to my Lord. I will finally be free.
Hey, better, 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 swing! Strike him out, strike him out! Come on, keep eyeing the ball, you can do it!
This time I'm hitting a home run. Yes, I did it.
Great swing, Kyrie. You are coming right along. All right, kids, let's wrap it up for today. See everybody next week.
Coach, would you teach me how to hit a curveball next week?
Sure thing, Kyrie. See you next week.
Operator.
Yes, there is a black man with a gun walking throughout the neighborhood. Send someone quick.
Please describe him.
He's black with a gun.
What's your name and location? Help is on the way.
Yes, I'm at...
I'm still standing. Yeah.
Drop the gun!
Wait, what? Why? What did I do? Help me. Help me.
Damn, Greg! It's a kid, and it's a baseball bat.
Damn!
A little later that day,
hello, are you Miss Black?
There was another police-involved shooting today. A 12-year-old black child was shot and killed on his way home from baseball practice. There will be a candlelight vigil and a rally at the ballpark tonight. Setting, a candlelight vigil at an open park for another black life taken by the police. Names of victims of police brutality are being spoken in the air between characters. Characters, black, with a capital B, white, privilege. White is crying hysterically on a bench next to Vigil. Black watches her from afar while waiting for her turn on the microphone. After moments of watching, Black walks over to White and sits down beside her. She then points to someone in the crowd. We are gathered here today, this evening, to honor young Kyrie.
Would you read what's on your card?
Oscar Grant.
And your card?
Sandra Bland.
Your card?
Tamir Rice.
And your card?
Trayvon Martin.
Whose streets? Our streets! Whose streets? Our streets! No justice, no peace! No justice, no peace. He was only a boy. He was only a boy.
Now, your daughter was with Tamir when he was in the park, and when she reacted, she was thrown to the ground by the police officers. Can you talk about your daughter and how she's doing now and what that impact had upon her then and now?
Her name is Tajay. Tajay was 14. At the time, and she was actually the third person on the scene. So the two officers then, Tajay. Tajay was tackled because she did not witness the shooting, but she was tackled trying to get to her brother, so that's how she ended up being tackled, running out the door, running across the grass to be tackled by two grown men and placed in handcuffs and basically forced to watch her brother die. Today, Tajay is 19 years old, and Tajay is still having difficulty times with the death of her brother, but just also growing up, still have to see that black and brown people are still being shot down with no justice. I mean, kids see social media all the time and things like that. So, you know, she did graduate by the grace of God. All my kids graduated by the grace of God, you know, because I pushed them, of course, but... So she has her days, you know. She has her days. Could she be doing better? Could all my kids be doing better? Yes.
Crying releases pain. Let it all out.
White looks up with a puddle of tears in her eyes.
But when your tears run dry, know that you have only released your pain, and that's it. Crying is no longer enough.
White begins to cry harder. Black sits and waits. After a few long minutes, the crying comes to an end.
That's right. That's right. Let it all out. Clean up your face. You look a mess.
How are you not crying right now?
I have cried my entire existence. My well dried long ago.
I just don't understand. How could he do this? How could he just shoot like that?
I don't know. All I know is that you're here. That says something about you.
I can't believe he did this.
Why are you here?
Because I know what is happening is so wrong. A child. He was just a child. He killed someone's child.
Do you want to understand?
Yes, of course I do.
I don't have much time, but if you truly want to understand, I can help you with that, but only under one condition.
Okay, what's the condition?
You have to promise that you will not make anything about you, no matter what I say. Can you do that?
I don't think I understand what you mean.
If you truly want to understand, it is imperative that you listen with an open heart, mind, soul, and body. In order to do this, you must acknowledge your white privilege and make the decision to be selfless or selfish. Only you can make that choice.
Okay, I can do that.
What you're about to hear is painfully honest. It's honest because it's my truth. You can't defend yourself when you don't agree because there's nothing to agree with. This is my truth. You can't justify or correct anything that I say. My truth can't be corrected. You must simply listen. Listen to my truth for what it is. I'm not asking for your opinion on my truth. My truth is my truth, and no one can tell me otherwise. Do you understand?
I understand. If I have questions, can I ask them?
Yes, please. Ask questions when you need clarification, but please think before you speak.
Okay. Sounds easy enough.
Black is anything but easy.
How long?
How long?
In order to understand your place in all of this turmoil, you got to put yourself in my shoes.
But how do I do that?
Shh. Listen, please, open the book to the first page and read the first line.
Black, with a capital B. Definition, one extreme end of the scale of grays opposite to white. We are opposites.
The flesh on our bodies are opposite shades, yes. We are not opposites. We are both very much human.
Why does it say black needs a capital B? Colors don't need to be capitalized.
Please, just remember our condition. Don't correct my truth. Only ask questions for clarification. Black is not a color. Black is the absence of color. Black is light.
Sorry.
Don't be sorry. I simply ask that you speak with intention. Before you speak, listen. Understand the root of your question. Before you ask a question, ask yourself if you'd like to be asked the same thing. You may be surprised how many times you may think again. Let me explain. Black needs a capital B because black is an identity. Black is a name. Black is the name that comes before any other adjective used to describe me. I am black before all else. Please understand, this isn't my choice, though, but what has been placed upon me.
How is it not the same for whites as well?
Please, remember our condition.
I guess I could rephrase that. Can you explain how it differs between white and black, please?
There you go. That's it. Think before you speak. The difference is that white is seen as the norm. The norm doesn't need to be described with specifics because it's the norm, the standard, and everyone knows the standard. In this world, anything outside of normal must be identified accordingly.
Okay, I think I understand what you're saying.
Black points across stage.
Do you see that lady over there?
Yes, the woman carrying the baby. What about her?
And do you see that lady over there?
Are you pointing to the black woman wearing a sundress?
A woman carrying a baby? A black woman wearing a sundress? A woman? A black woman. Do you know why you didn't use white to describe the woman holding her baby?
Well, I just...
Please, remember our condition. Acknowledge your privilege. Then decide whether to continue using it for yourself or for others who will never receive such a gift.
I chose not to use white to describe the woman carrying the baby because I was brought to believe that she is normal and anyone who looks different than her is not.
How does it feel for you to say that?
It feels like I'm admitting defeat.
If there is no superiority and inferiority, if all lives truly did matter, one would not have to admit defeat.
But...
Condition. Turn to the next page and read out loud, please.
Black lives matter.
Do you believe that?
Well, of course I do, but...
Remember our condition. Using but invalidates everything that comes before it. So let me ask you again. Do you believe black lives matter?
I believe that all lives matter.
That's not the question I asked.
Including black lives.
That's not the question I asked you. Do you believe black lives matter?
Yes, I do.
Then say it loud and proud so everyone can hear.
Black lives matter.
Again, please.
Is that really necessary?
Maybe, just maybe if we say it enough times, people will begin to listen. So please, again.
Black lives matter.
One more time, please.
Black lives matter.
What does that mean?
Is this a trick question?
No, it's not.
It means exactly what it says, that black lives matter.
In the statement, black lives matter, does it say anything about other lives not mattering?
Well, no, it doesn't say that, but it implies it.
Implies it? How so?
Saying black lives matter is not an inclusive statement. It creates division and it leaves people out.
What people are left out?
Well, you know.
White people?
All people, I think.
You think? I saw something on Facebook the other day that really hit the nail on the head for me, and I'd like to share it with you.
Okay.
The post read, "No one goes to a breast cancer awareness walk and says lung cancer matters too. Everyone knows that the awareness walk is simply focused on breast cancer and that on any other day, there are other walks for other kinds of cancers, including lung cancer." Do you agree with that?
Well, yes, of course. It wouldn't make sense to combine two cancer awareness walks together.
Is a breast cancer awareness walk inclusive to all cancers?
No, the purpose is to specialize and focus on breast cancer.
And you're okay with that?
Well, yes, of course. Why wouldn't I be?
Do you think it's fair to say that the purpose of Black Lives Matter is to specialize and focus in on black lives? You said so yourself, that things don't have to be all inclusive.
Well, yes, but...
Condition. Black Lives Matter is saying something so simple. Black lives matter. That's all. If you're saying all lives matter or blue lives matter, you're saying black lives do not matter. Black Lives Matter is not an anti-police or anti-white movement. Black Lives Matter is simply demanding that our black sons and our black daughters need to be treated as human beings and nothing less than. Black Lives Matter is asking for acceptance and equality. Nothing more, nothing less.
Let's bring up our next speaker, Black. Show her some love, y'all. Yeah. Woo.
Yeah. Equality. All we are asking for is equality. We are asking for black to stop being a death sentence. We are asking for you to let our children be free. As we gather here tonight, reflecting on a little boy whose life was taken because of the color of his skin, I want you to remember what it means to be black. I want to remember both the glory and the pain that comes with this skin. Black. Say it with me. Black.
Black.
One more time.
Black.
What a beautifully weighted word. So complex. So divine. So rich. Tonight, let us remember with voices across our nation what being black is. Black is. Black is rich. Rich in depth, in creativity, in stamina, in integrity. Black is the pain of difference and the beauty of culture, the freedom to be.
Black is knowing innocent until proven guilty does not apply to melanin-rich skin. Black is an inspiring beauty, mocked but imitated by all.
Black is fearing your little brother will be shot in the street because his Mickey Mouse snapback says, "Shoot me, I'm guilty."
Black is being labeled a thug no matter where you come from.
Black is coming from a lineage of kings and queens.
Black is modern-day slavery, mass incarcerations, the new Jim Crow.
Black is deep, the core of the universe through which all things were created.
Black is burning your child's scalp and telling her her pain is equivalent to her beauty.
Black is taking back your crown and glory, allowing your tresses to be wild and free.
Black is inherent strength, ultimate resilience.
Black is the mother who does everything on her own, for the destruction of our families has never been repaired.
Black is light skin, dark skin, forced internal division.
Black is knowing my death will be celebrated, mocked, and ignored. Black is so intense, our presence alone forces the privileged out of their comfort zones.
Black is being reduced to a hashtag, a trending topic. She asked me why I was here. How could I not be? Brokenhearted spouse of a policeman who's come to realize that the man she loves and adores is the bad guy on the news. A killer cop. Father of my children. My life partner. My best friend. A killer cop. I have watched that video over and over again, trying to understand, trying to justify continuing to support this man. He's an amazing father to our kids. He loves children. But what if this was our boy? I keep asking him why he pulled the trigger. He says he was afraid. It was an accident. How could he be afraid of a 12-year-old child carrying a baseball bat? How could his death be an accident? He was just a little boy with a bat. He killed a child because he was holding a baseball bat. Our son plays baseball. But our son isn't black.
When he killed my child, he killed my dreams. My boy, my sweet baby boy. We were just starting to plan his 13th birthday party. He was so excited to be a teenager finally. My boy. From the age that he could understand me, I've always told him to be respectful and quiet in the streets. I told him that when police stop to search you on your way home, kick the anger aside and comply. I told my baby that he must comply, that he must lay his ego to rest so that I, his mother, would never have to. I told him not to be afraid, that mommy would always be here waiting for him to come home. My baby boy, my sweet baby boy, he didn't come home this time. He didn't come home. I was waiting for him. I wonder if he was waiting for me. as he bled out on the street. I wonder if he knew he was lying beside his killer's feet. When my boy took his final breath, I wonder if he knew that his life mattered, that despite what the world thinks, he was worthy. A week ago today, my son was taken from me by the hands of police brutality. A little black boy with a baseball bat, guilty. Being black meant that he didn't just finish baseball practice. Being black meant that he was a threat, guilty. My 12-year-old innocent little boy, they labeled him guilty. Guilty. A charge they will never even see. I don't know what my son was waiting for the day he was killed by the police, but I'm done waiting. When he killed my child, he killed my dreams. And I refuse to wait for another mother's dreams to bleed out of holes staining the street. I am so sorry. I don't blame you for your privilege. I know you didn't ask for it, just as I didn't ask to not receive it. It's simply the card we were each given. We have no say in that. I know that.
Speaking to audience.
To all of you, I do blame you if you continue to choose to live in the dark. White is not equivalent to oppressor if one doesn't want it to be. I blame you if you continue to deny the heartbreaking truth that slavery was never abolished, that I am still not free. I blame you if you choose to see that all lives don't matter because black lives have never mattered in this country. You must choose to stand up for those voices who are not heard. You must make the decision to stop using your privilege to further your own agenda.
Speaking to white.
Black needs a capital B because black is my name. Black is my truth, my history. Black is light. Black is light. It's simple, really. For there are only three options for you to be: my accomplice, my ally, or my enemy. You've acknowledged your privilege, and that's the first step, so I thank you for that. My hope is that whenever you speak, you will always remember your condition. So let us remember. Michael Brown.
Michael Brown.
Philando Castile.
Philando Castile.
Alton Sterling.
Alton Sterling.
Amadou Diallo.
Amadou Diallo.
Freddie Gray.
Freddie Gray.
Eric Garner.
Eric Garner.
John Crawford.
John Crawford.
Walter Scott.
Walter Scott.
Deborah Danner.
Deborah Danner.
Terrence Crutcher.
Terrence Crutcher.
Laquan McDonald.
Laquan McDonald.
Charlena Lyles.
Charlena Lyles.
Jordan Edwards.
Jordan Edwards.
Rakia Boyd.
Rakia Boyd.
Ayanna Jones.
Ayanna Jones.
Jamel Roberson.
Jamel Roberson.
Beverly Grant.
Beverly Grant.
This episode of Destination Freedom was presented by the Robert and Judy Newman Center for the Performing Arts at the University of Denver. The cast for Black with a capital B included such as Black, Deborah Keyes as White, Andrew Jacob Betts as Kyrie, Carrie Joy, various voices, music and theme by Monique Brooks Roberts. Foley is Ita Gabriel. Our stage manager is Damian Hoover. And engineer is Dave Aston. I'm producer and director Donnie L. Betts. And now joining Destination Freedom are playwright LaMaria Amina, Aurora Police Chief Nick Mex, Aurora Council Member Angela Lawson, Professor Dr. Deborah Ortiz, Denver Police Division Chief Ron Thomas, and Rashawn Blitz, student organizer for Project Voice. And later, musical guest Monique.
So I want to start with LaMaria to talk about what was the genesis for bringing this play to us in the first place?
Good evening, everyone.
My name is Lamari Amina, and I'm the playwright. I wrote this play when I was 20 years old. It was my first play, and I wrote it through Curious New Voices program at Curious Theater. It was the summer Philando Castile and Alton Sterling were both murdered, and Trump was entering our office, and Obama was leaving. And there was just a lot happening in our world, and I was trying to make sense of it all in the best way that I knew how, and that was writing. And so that's how I just poured my heart in pain and, you know, my ancestors' pain, my family's pain, all into this play.
Thank you so much. So first, let's talk with the impressions that our panel had of the play. Coming in, not really knowing a lot about it, maybe just a little bit of blurbs that I sent you. Just anyone can comment. Don't be afraid.
Well, I'll go ahead and comment. Mm-hmm.
This is Councilmember Angela Lawson.
It was very powerful. For me, being in a city council, one of the things that the community and the kids, that when I do outreach to kids in our community, is what are you doing as the leadership? You know, are we really getting out there and addressing this issue? You know, just me being an African American woman, I've been told this. When I get pulled over by an officer, keep your hands on the wheel, don't reach. Angela, don't wear a hoodie. A lot of people look at my skin color and they say, well, you have some advantages. No, I'm still a black woman, and I still have to face some of the things that were mentioned in this play when we're looking at race. When we're looking at our kids, there is some fear in the community, but they asked me when I go out in there, what are you doing, Councilmember Lawson? What are you doing to make a difference and to address our concerns? We work with our police officers, our police chief will expand more, but they're really talking about the leadership in the community. And I don't think, and I'm talking for myself, that we get out there enough to address this issue. And what this brought to me is more about what I, as an individual council member, need to do to address these issues of violence in our community, kids in our community, and addressing our police departments and how we're actually relating with each other in the community with kids and with our public. So that's kind of what it brought home to me. It was very powerful to see the differences. Because I am an African-American woman, I do see where there is definitely differences in how people are perceived, even at the leadership position. Some of the things I've faced on this in my community, it's not good, but you have to stand strong and make sure that you fight for these things and stand that we do matter. So, thank you.
We hear from Police Chief.
Good evening. I'm Nick Metz. I'm the Police Chief for Aurora. I know I don't really look like it right now. Apologize for that. I thought the play was incredibly profound from the standpoint of, I've been in law enforcement now for 35 years. My first 31 years was with the Seattle Police Department. And while with the Seattle Police Department, certainly was involved in a number of situations where there were controversial police actions. When I came to Aurora, in March of 2014, or 2015, excuse me, and the second day on my job, we had a controversial police shooting. And this was right in the middle of Ferguson, it was right in the middle of Baltimore, it was right in the middle of Cleveland. And I think what was pretty profound for me as I heard the names that were being mentioned earlier and then at the end of the play was that I think at least probably 95% of the names that were mentioned, I knew exactly which city they occurred in. You know, in law enforcement, and I know the same holds true with Denver PD, you know, we can never rest on our laurels. We can never say that we have the best policies and we have the best procedures. We're constantly working towards making sure that our training is as best as it can be, our equipment is as best as it can be, that we are screening our officers and new officers as best that we can. But we can never get to a point where we say we've got it down. Because if we do that, then we realize, you know what, we don't. And so we have to constantly be willing to really take critical looks at ourselves. And part of taking that critical look is making sure that we have folks in our community, whether it's residents, whether it's lawmakers, whether it's teachers, whether it's young people, who we are willing to actually sit down with and have the difficult conversations. I can tell you that a number of the policies and procedures and the trainings and bias-free training and things like that that we've conducted, a lot of that has come from what the community has stressed as being important. And that really comes down to us being willing to listen and being willing to really, again, take a critical look at ourselves and being willing to say, these are our shortcomings and we have to improve on that. And so I guess where my message to this is that I come to a lot of meetings and events like this where people come, they share their frustrations, and then they leave, and then we never hear from them again until the next crisis. And it's really important because I know for sure it happens in Denver. I can assure you it happens in Aurora, that we want to hear from our community, that we provide avenues to hear from our community, that we're not afraid to have the difficult discussions. We invite them. And because we as law enforcement want to be better. We want to serve our communities better. We want to reflect the makeup of our communities. And to do that, it requires the community to be part of that change.
Thank you.
My name is Rashawn Bliss. I'm one of the co-founders of a group called the Denver Justice Project that really arose out of the Black Lives Matter movement and the community's kind of frustration, anger, pain around police violence. And my reaction, I mean, obviously it was a really deeply powerful play and I felt a lot of things. I think one, I appreciated the condition that kept coming back up, that we agree not to make, that the Black woman and the white woman speaking agreed not to make the conversation about the white woman. And I think one of my strongest reactions was that I found myself wishing that collectively we, as a community, as a society, could have a conversation about police where the police would agree to that condition too. I happen to know both the police officers here. I think they're very good men and I respect them. And I think that there's a deeper conversation to be had about the institution of policing in the same way that play was helping show that there's a deeper conversation to be had about the institution of whiteness. And I think that it hurts to be able to, in the same way that the frustration of the constant interrupting and the constant having to correct and come back to remember the condition, happens with Black-white conversations, I think that it happens with cop, non-cop conversations too. And I think that a real deep examination of the institution of policing and its history, its evolution here in our country will take us to some difficult to discuss places. That, you know, one of the first recognizable as modern policing units in the United States was the Charleston Garden Watch. It was a slave patrol. And that was, you know, 30 years before what's often credited as the first police force in London, the Bobbies, quote unquote. And I think that was one of my strongest reactions, that I think we should have a conversation about the facts of that history with that condition, that we not make this about, you know, attacking individual police officers or family members who we know who are in the service, but that we could have a conversation about the institution itself, what it means, what it grew out of, and then we could start to see some of the continuity and understand some of the patterns over history and why these things keep happening. And that might help us have these conversations about the individual incidents that happen in our communities take a different shape.
You know, if I could just quickly add to Rashawn's comments, we certainly do those deeper conversations, and I think thankfully. I think the Aurora Police Department, the Denver Police Department, we're now willing to have those discussions. I think we realize that it's necessary. I think we both realize that that it's a long time coming. We've got a lot of work to do to regain and earn that trust of the community, particularly the Black community. One of the things that resonated the most with me in this piece was just kind of the, I think, eloquent descriptions of privilege and. Explaining the whole, Black Lives Matter. I think that when those things are said, white privilege and Black Lives Matter, I think people tend to bristle at that. I have no privilege, but clearly it's there. I think it was very eloquently explained and detailed in the piece. And just my own experience, I'm not sure I've ever been described by people on my own force as just the chief. I think I'm well recognized as the Black police chief.
Professor, I'd like to hear from you.
So first of all, this is Dr. Deborah Ortega. I'm a faculty member at the Graduate School of Social Work, and I am actually predominantly responsible for a class that all of our students take called Power, Privilege, and Oppression. And I just would really like to thank the playwright one more time. That was amazing. You did in a half an hour what it takes me 10 weeks to do. I should turn in my little professor cap or something. I had actually some physical reactions. So in the part where there's the protest and it's the call and response for the protest, I actually had chills come up the back of my legs because I've been there, right? I have been in those protests around the ways that people are dehumanized because of the color of their skin or because of their gender orientation or because of their sexual orientation or because of all of the above all at once. So that was really powerful for me. It really set me in that moment. I love the way the dialogue happens in terms of the that it is a dialogue, right? That there is a dialogue between Black and white. I still think I might need the rest of the 10 weeks to explain to my students. I'm here at the University of Denver. It's a predominantly white university. I still would need 10 weeks to explain often to our master level white students why and how white gets centered, maybe in this moment, in this play, but all the ways that white takes up space. And conversely, how when you're white, often we use the Ferguson Report in the class. If you've never read the Ferguson Report and you're here, you should. It's an amazing report, and one by the Department of Justice of many that they have done. One of the things I'm really clear about is that when white people benefit from the color of their skin, they don't always know because they're one person among white people. So in Ferguson, their cases were dismissed some 60%, something like that, more, right, than white people. But it wasn't like the white people whose cases were being dismissed were aware that they were a part of this large group or that Black people weren't experiencing it because they didn't have to, because they didn't live in communities together, because they didn't communicate together, because they didn't do the dialogue that was so beautiful right in this play. So I just want to say I have a lot to say about this topic in general, but in terms of a reaction, this was so beautifully done. And I hope someday that I teach as well as she did this play, when she was, 20? So thank you very much. I would really like to use this actually in our class, in our classes, because I think it so eloquently talks about the dynamics, right, between being afraid of losing power, being afraid to recognize your power, and being afraid to recognize the everyday pain and danger people are in because of the color of their skin.
Thank you so much.
Hi, I'm Harry Glidden. I'm a division chief of the Aurora Police Department.
Just get a little closer to it.
I think the play was a perfect example about how we have to talk to each other without defending our position. That listening is actually a skill, and in order to improve our relationship with our community, we actually have to sit and listen to our community, not to defend our position, not defend or juxtapose our position with some other position, but to simply listen to the information that's being given, listen to the pain that's there. That's not easy to accept sometimes. It's a difficult thing to sit and listen to, especially when you are the object of white privilege, when you're being identified as the enemy of whatever's going on. And too bad, you just need to sit there and listen. You need to understand. Through many of these kind of conversations, policing has evolved. Certainly in Aurora it's evolved. We don't do things that today that we did when I got on 35 years ago. And quite frankly, we're happy about that. I would hate to go back to doing the things that we did 35 years ago. They were stupid. So I think that powerful dynamic in the play was important to listen, the requirement to listen without defending.
Thank you so much. And I wanted to say I appreciated the comments of Rashawn and Chief Metz, because one of the things that they both brought up in different ways is the fact that the crisis is there, you react to it, you demonstrate, you protest, or whatever the case may be, and then you do disappear. So that's on us as a community. So one of my questions to everyone, and I've been working with for the last year or so with the Aurora Police, and just Wednesday I spent the whole day at the academy to see what the cadets were going through, and just to watch their faces and all these young kids, and, you know, they are scared. You know, they want to be good citizens and serve you as the public, but they have issues about how to do that too, just from watching them and talking to the trainers there and everything. But the trainers are opening and open to people from the community like myself and mental health workers and people like that to talk about them, how we can make this better. So in just a few minutes, I'm gonna open it up to the audience, but first, before I do that, I want to make sure that I get any comments from the cast that want to offer anything like that. Today we had a powerful, this morning we had a performance for high schoolers, and that was profound. Many of them were really impacted by that, you know. And the first question I always ask is, who in here, by the show of hands, has been impacted by violence, police violence, you know, domestic violence, whatever the case may be? There's never a place that I've ever been. We've been to a lot of places with this play and other places that I've been that a hand is not raised. It's usually 10, 15 people that raise their hand. So this impacts us all. What's important about this, I wanted to start the play with comments from Samaria Rice, who's the mother of Tamara Rice. When you heard that clip, that's who that was. I wanted to talk about what happens after. We know what happens in the front when CNN or whatever is out there covering it. But when they leave, what happens? As he said, my life has never been the change, never been the same since I heard the knock on the door. I was thrown into this. I didn't ask for it. I was thrown into this. It's the same when an officer responds to a call and something goes awry. They didn't ask for it. They were thrown into it. So just as me as a citizen, I have a much more greater appreciation for what the men and women of the police force go through. So we have to have that serious conversation, as you said. The conversation happens on both sides. You know, it can't be a monologue. It has to be a conversation that happens. So if anyone from the cast would like to make a quick comment, we'll go with that before we go to the for the audience for just for a couple questions. Anyone? Okay, no? I know, Sut, you had so many things to say today. You wanna, yeah. Why don't you come out here so we don't get any feedback?
So I'm Such. I played Black. This play was very touching for me because I have an 8-year-old Black son, and I have you know, a husband who was black. And Philando Castile, I remember watching that Facebook Live video and just feeling like my heart was being like just wrenched out of my chest, because it just felt so, it felt so personal. I was like, oh, that could be me. And I think for me, I try to navigate, what does it look like as my son grows up? Like, what kind of world is he going to live in? And right now he's 8, but at some point he's going to be 12, he's going to be 14, and he's going to look big, and he's going to be a big black man at some point. And but when he's 12 and 14, he's going to be possibly a threat. And without the, you know, the maturation of being able to know, you know, walk into a room and look a little bit, you know, smile or whatever else, he might be, you know, going through whatever teenagers go through and just look mean, and who knows what that looks like. So I feel like for me, I go through this thing of, I don't want to take away the essence of who he is, but I also don't want him to die. And that's something that I'm thinking of for my 8-year-old right now. I think it's such an important conversation to have. Another thing that I was thinking of, honestly, and this is just thinking about how I feel about the police. I realize that they're not the people that I would call if anything really went down. And that's really scary for me, because I feel like I should be able to call the police. So for example, my neighbor the other day, she had somebody come and bang on her door and she was terrified. And so she called the police, and then, you know, she called me, and she's white. And I thought, would that have been like my first choice? Would I have called 911 if I was afraid of my house? And the reality is that I wouldn't have. And I don't want that to be the case. I want to be able to have these conversations. I want to be able to feel like I can, because I know that they're here to serve and protect us. So I'd like to be able to feel that. So, yeah.
Yes.
Hi, I'm Devra. I played white. And we talked about this earlier today, but a lot of this affected me deeply coming from a white perspective. Of course, when I hear about all the tragedies that happen in the shootings, it's horrifying and it's devastating, but I can never put myself in the place of a black person and feel that fear, because that is not my experience. And I think there are a lot of white people who are well-intentioned. That line that you included with, well, I think all lives matter, we don't always realize how that diminishes and just makes that whole black condition minimized. And it's with good intention, and yet it is one of the most horrible things that we can do, is to say, oh, all lives matter. And being in this play, that opened my mind to that, and I realized I was guilty of that thought. And it's really changed my thinking quite a bit. So thank you for that. I appreciate that.
I wanted to make just a brief comment to something that Such said in talking about being a black woman with a black son. About 3 years ago, I met with a group of black women. It was about 8 or 9 at a salon. All of them had black sons. And when we met, the discussion came up with the fact that they lived, and we talk about the condition. And the condition is that for many, particularly black women with black sons, there's a double-edged sword. They live with a double-edged sword. When they're, particularly with a teenage son, when their teenage son goes out on a Friday or Saturday night, they're worried about two things. Either their son is going to be shot and killed by police, or their son is going to be shot and killed by someone else, a gang member or someone out there just being stupid. Sadly, one of the women in that group, her son was killed in a drive-by shooting. I believe it was in Denver. I say this not in any way, shape, or form to diminish or minimize the topic that we're talking about here when we're talking about police violence. But the reality is, in many ways, is that we are picking up bodies of young black men every single day. In Aurora, just the last 3 weeks, we've had 3 young men whose lives have been taken away. Just the other day, a 16-year-old male lured another 16-year-old male, shot him in the head. A week and a half ago at the Aurora Mall, another young man was shot and killed. And again, not diminishing the other side of this that what we're talking about, but it goes to the condition, and it goes to the issue of the violence that we are dealing with on our streets. You know, the violence that's occurring in Denver, the violence that's occurring in Aurora, the violence that's occurring in Lakewood, and in many cases, we're seeing the funerals in our city. And unfortunately, when a young man, a young black man is killed by gang violence or youth violence or whatever it is, the sad part of this is that when I call a community member and say, you know, our community leaders and tell them, we just had a homicide and this is what's going on, the typical response is, gosh, that's really sad. Thanks for letting me know. The typical response is, that's really sad. Thanks for letting us know. And I can tell you that a mother's pain is going to be no different no matter how that son died. The dream is lost. We talked about that in the condition. And so when we're talking about issues of police violence, we also cannot forget the issues of violence on our streets. And at some point, we've got to get angry about this. And at some point, we've got to say no more. Because the level of violence out there right now is absolutely staggering. It's absolutely staggering.
So great, it leads me right into, thank you. As I said earlier, that's why I always ask the question of people, how have they been impacted by violence? It doesn't have to be police violence, just violence. What tasks would I ask law enforcement up here? What tasks are you going to task the community with? I just said more response, more responsibility. What else can the community do to bridge that gap that's not being bridged now? As you said, you're picking up bodies every day, so you see it, you're on the front lines. You know, we may hear about it, we may read about it, and we move on. We're guilty of it as anybody else. What can we do? What's our task?
You know, I think whether we're talking about police violence or youth violence, just violence in our community, I think that the task is just to keep that conversation going. You know, I think what always happens, you know, I've sat in, I can't even count anymore the number of forums related to various police incidents that have occurred across the country, and that forum is over and the conversation doesn't come up again until the next incident. And unfortunately, those incidents aren't often very far apart, but still, I think that, you know, the conversation should not be driven by the next incident. The conversation should be driven by the fact that we've not solved it, we've not come up with answers.
How you guys doing? My name is Carrie Joy. I think it might have been really important that I actually did go after you guys because I was going to talk about something that you did mention. I'm really grateful that we're having this conversation. And one thing that struck me when you were speaking, can you remind me of your name?
Harry.
Harry. When Harry was speaking, you were talking about the fact that over time, over 35 years, things have changed within the police department. And you said that you were happy because at one point in time, the things that were, you know, that were happening were stupid. And I'm not 100% sure, you know, what that means from your perspective and your experience. But what struck me was the fact that the onus is on us, especially when we are witnessing a lot of these these situations that are upholding a certain power structure, to simply tell the truth about what's going on. And this is not it's not me, it's you conversation. This is just us having a conversation about the truth. One thing that always bothered me, especially when the Black Lives Matter movement begun, was this conversation about black on black crime. And I was going to say this before you guys even brought this up. So I just think it was pretty important that I even went afterwards. But the fact that anytime I would try to have a conversation with someone about it, they would be like, well, what about black on black crime? Trust and believe that we feel that too. And we have to understand and recognize the power structures that are creating this crabs in the barrel type mentality at the same time. And when we're seeing, when we're in these systems that are upholding a certain power structure, we have to be willing to tell the truth, just like me as a Black woman has to be willing to tell the truth about what's going on in my community and holding my community members accountable for the actions that are taking place and the violence that is that we are causing to one another. We all have to be responsible for telling that truth. But we do have to understand that there is a system and there is a power structure that a lot of people within our communities, we're also fighting against that every day. And one thing that always bothers me a lot of times when I go into community meetings and people are saying, well, community's not showing up. I'm not saying that there aren't community members that aren't present, but there are so many times when they're working, when they're tired, when they have full-time jobs, and then they have to have another full-time job to hold people within these systems accountable for their actions. And the thing is that there are so many times where the crimes that are taking place from these power systems upon people that are disenfranchised, there is no accountability. And the pain a lot of times that I'm noticing is so much deeper and so much greater because it seems as if nobody is listening. Nobody is listening to the fact that, yes, my child, yes, you know, maybe there was a child that was killed, by a gang member. And generally, there is, hopefully, there is a goal of, the police force to go ahead and find the person that is accountable. But a lot of times in these situations where there are police members that are actually the ones causing this violence, there are too many times that there is not this accountability. And all I'm trying to say is that the onus is on every single one of us to tell the truth when we are recognizing what is going on. And if for so many years, we see the stupidity, and I'm just using that word because you used it. We see the stupidity that is happening, and maybe we're not telling the truth, or maybe we're not, we're afraid of the power structure, to punish us in a certain way. But we have to be bold, because if we're asking community to be bold, then people that are within these particular power structures that are witnessing this have to be bold as well. And like I said, this is not a it's not me, it's you type of conversation. I just want to make sure that we are all understanding that the truth has to be revealed in every sector. And that's it.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Carrie. I want to add that a huge part of this question of, people know me in Denver as a police accountability activist. And I think it's really important for us to understand what that word accountability means. I think accountability has four parts, that it's recognizing the harm as harm and admitting that it was your fault or that you caused it. Intentions be damned, that's what happened. Two is doing something that it's acknowledging the harm and stopping it. Stopping the harm is the second part. That you actually if you stepped on someone's foot, that you get off their foot. Three is making amends to the extent that that's possible. But the most important part of accountability that we basically never get from our justice system on either side is changing so it doesn't happen again. That's one of the most important parts of when you know someone's taken accountability for something, they've changed the way that they act so that the mistake they made, the harm that they did, doesn't happen again. And I think that is something that because of the way that our society thinks about police and is so afraid of questioning the institution, because it conflates them with the people, keeps us from doing that changing so it doesn't happen again part. And I think that, the question of what's the community's role when this violence happens, I think that a huge part of it is for us to change so it doesn't happen again. But I think that a huge part of that is learning that our officers, police are doing some things that in some ways prevent violence, but for the by and large, they're not. They respond to the killing. They show up after the shots have been fired, and they're not actually able to stop the violence that happens in the community Yet we spend in Denver, I don't know what it's like in Aurora, but I know that in Denver, almost or more than half of our city budget goes to the safety department. And I think that what the community is supposed to do about the violence in our community is get some of that money directed to stuff that works, that actually prevents these problems. Because I should be clear that I am glad that there are police in our communities. I am happy that our society has created a way to rapidly respond to a situation like the Aurora Theater shooting. Please believe that I'm stoked about that. And I think that we give them, frankly, too many responsibilities, and we expect police to be able to when you're holding a hammer, every problem looks like a nail, and the police are the hammer in our society's hands. Every problem looks like a damn nail, and we send people with paramilitary and legal training to handle a mental illness episode, a drug overdose, chronic homelessness. What the community needs to do is redirect some of those resources to solutions that actually work.
Yeah, thank you.
I know you.
Thank you so much. I heard this over and over when I was at the academy, that our responsibilities are so great. Being the police department, our responsibilities are so great now, we don't know what to do, because we have to be all things to all people all the time. Professor, you're going to have the last word.
So first of all, I just like this. I want to be witness to the things that you've said. I grew up in L.A. I am old. I am 56. I grew up in a very dangerous neighborhood in L.A.
We're not that old.
So here's the deal. I have a PhD, and I have smoked windows on my Mercedes because I'm afraid of the police. And I'm just saying that because I just want to witness what you said. But I will say this. I think we're very remiss if we think the racial violence was with the shooting. It actually was with the phone call. That was actually the first racial violent moment. And if we forget that, then when we talk community, we only mean the Black community in this context. And that is not what this is about, right? This is about our community, even though we tend not to live together, right? So I think that's the place we need to stop and think. Racial violence started with the phone call.
By a round of applause, please give our panel just all your love you can give.
Thanks for listening for Destination Freedom. Follow us on Facebook at No Credits Production LLC, on Twitter at Black Radio Days, and on Instagram at No Credits Production LLC. Hashtag No Credits Production LLC. I'm your host, Donnie Betts. Follow me at Donnie Betts on Twitter. Thank you so much for listening to our first podcast of Destination Freedom, Black Radio Days. Special thanks goes to Bonfrey Stanford Foundation.
Have you ever wondered how your favorite performer actually feels? Well, here's your chance. Welcome to The Quiet Part Out Loud with me, Bobby Steggert, Broadway actor, and now a therapist to a whole host of Broadway creatives. Part interview, part therapy, this is not your typical podcast. We'll go right to the heart of things with some of your favorite artists, what they still struggle with, what lessons they've learned, what they haven't figured out yet. There's enormous power in saying the quiet part out loud. Are you listening?
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org, because only together we rise.